Good afternoon. The House Education Finance Committee will come to order. So before we get started, I think we have probably several members that have student shadows with them today. We have leaders from FCCLA with us. So I would invite any members that have a shadow with them to go ahead and introduce your shadow to us. And we would love to have this shadow stand up so we can see you. Representative Marquardt, raise his hands first, and then I'll go to you, Representative Benavent. I know it's a this is a highly sought honor. So
well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I do have a representative, Jacob Just from Morris.
Welcome. So. Thank you.
And he was the past president of the organization, I believe, last year. So
fantastic. Very good. Thank you for being with us. And let's see. And then I'll go to Representative Bennett and then to you. And I know Representative Poston has one, too. Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, Noelle, if you stand up, this is Noelle Koenig. She is from Pine Island.
Very good. Thank you for being with us, Noelle. Representative Sanston.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have two students that are shadowing me today, overachiever. Yeah, I know.
One in every class.
There it is. This is Morgan. Morgan is from Wadena. And with her, we also have Ava from Casson Manterville.
Very good. Welcome. Welcome. All right, we'll just work around the table. Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was a long read. I have a student, too, Lindsay. From Laverne, yeah. Linda, Lindsay, Laverne, we're the la, 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 la.
That works well. Thank you. Welcome, Lindsay. All right, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have Emma from Wadena. She's a cute little thing. And she last year wrote an essay on sexual violence and trafficking. Ooh. And so I've given her a copy of Representative Jessup's bill. And I think it's pretty impressive that she was ahead of us. So
fantastic.
Great to have her.
Thank you so much. Thank you for being here. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have Lillian Olson from Herman Norcross visiting with me today.
Hello, Lillian. Welcome. Representative Peterson, do you have a shadow?
I don't think so.
I'm her shadow.
Okay. All right, good. I don't want anyone to feel left out. Representative Poston.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have Paige Bartle from Wadena.
Thank you, Paige. I got the honor of meeting Paige before we started. I think Wadena must get the prize. You've got a lot of people here today. I've heard that town come up more than once. Any other members? Representative Tates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have Alex Ulitalo, who is here today.
Right.
And he is from Roseau. He goes to Badger.
Wow. Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you for being here. All right, thank you to all of our student leaders. We're always happy whenever we can have students who join us here at the committee. We welcome your participation, and if we have time, if anybody wants to share anything with the full committee, we will allow that at the end of the session. So just Representative Peterson.
I do want to point out there are several students here from Burnsville High School as well, and they're behind me, so please stand.
Come on, you can do it.
All right.
Yay, woo!
Yes. Thank you,
thank you, Madam.
From Burnsville. We appreciate you being here. Are they here with a specific program or?
Madam Chair, they're with the high school, so all okay. The students are here, and they are here in force.
Yes.
They're awesome.
There's many students here. So other students, did I miss anybody? FCCLA or otherwise? Nope. Okay. All right. Thank you so much. Thank you all for being here. All right. So let's take care of business first. Has anyone had a chance to review the minutes for our meeting from yesterday? Representative Poston.
Madam Chair, I have reviewed the minutes, and I would like to move them.
All right. The minutes, Representative Poston moves adoption of the minutes from March 6th. Any questions? If not, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Poston. All right. One little bit of housekeeping, and mostly for those who follow and participate in a number of our hearings. we don't have a specific rule in our committee rules about this, but just for the sort of consideration of our staff and getting materials ready for the hearing and for the interest of those who like to access their materials online, I'm going to ask anyone who's testifying or presenting to please make sure you get your materials to our committee, a legislative assistant or administrator by 9 a.m. the day of the hearing. The last couple of days, we've gotten stuff really late or people showing up with their copies, and it really creates sort of some confusion. We'd like to be able to utilize the pages. They show up to stuff the packets and get that done. So please, you can if you want to just send a copy electronically, just make sure we have it by 9, and we'll get it duplicated and in the packets and copies made for the public. So I would just ask for everyone's cooperation if we can try to do that. And so with that, our housekeeping is kind of taken care of. So today we are going to kind of continue on with what I'd like to do is to have hearings covering sort of our programs and doing a deep dive into the programs and some of the things that we fund through education finance. And before I go to that, I want to thank the members again for what I thought was a really good and productive hearing yesterday. We did go a little bit long. We came back at 5 and went, I think, about an hour or so. But I think really good and thoughtful ideas and that brought forward. So I want to thank everyone for that and their participation. So today we are going to be looking at community education programs. And, you know, those are a number of things that fall under that umbrella. Youth development, adults with disabilities, those may be things you're not aware of that are funded through community ed. ECFE, which many of you are familiar with, as well as our adult basic education program. So I would first like to have nonpartisan staff give us a little overview of sort of the basic community ed funding and that program. And then after that, with that base of knowledge, we'll have Representative Joaquim present her bill. Mr. Strong.
Madam Chair, members, in the folder with House File 625 is a printout that addresses the issue I've been asked to speak on for a moment. The community education formula, essentially for the oversight program for community education, has something called its basic formula level. And that amount is set at $5.42 times the number of residents in the school district boundaries. That's residents of all ages, not just student-age students. So the printout that you've got in the folder with House File 625, the very left-hand column of data shows the census count, the population within each school district's border. And under the current law, the basic community ed revenue is simply $5.42 times the count to the census count of the district. The basic community ed revenue is subject to a small amount of equalization, and you can see in the second and third columns there that the levy is nearly all of it, about $39.5 million of levy and $372,000 of state aid. Increasing that allowance from $5.42 to the amount in the bill to $7.67 causes about a $12 million increase in revenue. And as the overall revenue grows, because of the way the community ed levy is set as a rate, the majority is picked up as a levy, but a smaller amount becomes state aid as well. So out of the $12.6 million attributable to that increase, 10.9 would fall to the levy, and 1.7 million would go against state aids. So, Madam Chair, the increase from $5.42 to $7.67 is about a $12.6 million item.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Strom. Any questions for Mr. Strom just on the understanding the program? All right. Seeing none, Representative Joaquim, please go ahead and join us at the testifier table.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the chance to present House File 625 today.
All right. And I will go ahead and move your bill. I will move that House File 625 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or further action at a later time. So now it's formally before us. Representative Joaquim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was notified by House Counsel that since I introduced it last year, there may be some quick date changes we need to make, and that would be on line 1.9 and 1.11. We'd have to change 2019 to 2020. And I don't know how you'd like to handle that.
All right. So the chair will go ahead and make an oral amendment that the date on line 1.19 and 1.11 be changed. Oh, I'm sorry, 1.9 and 1.11 be changed from 2019 to 2020. All right. Any questions? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. The bill is now in the shape that the author would like. Please go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, for making that technical correction. As you can see, this bill increases the general community education revenue from $5.42 to $7.67. Little background, in 1987, the original general levy and aid formula was set at about $5.95 per capita. In 2003, it was reduced down to $5.23. And while some of that loss was recouped in 2005 when it was raised to $5.42, the formula still hasn't rebounded from the cuts from 14 years ago. So that's where we're sitting right now. Community education is a statewide delivery system that provides universal access for the youngest to the oldest Minnesotans, and the general education, community education levy provides the crucial infrastructure for quality community education programs that are in all of our districts. And I can almost guarantee you that everyone at this at these tables, or if not everyone in this room, has had personal experience in programs funded by community education dollars. These dollar funds, as the chair said, programs like ECFE, adult basic education, programs for adults with disabilities, school age care before and after school, as well through the summer, summer enrichment programs, and lifelong learning opportunities for adults and seniors. Personally, I experienced community education funding in many different forms, but mostly with my three children as they went through ECFE in Hopkins. Not only I appreciated it not only for the great education that they got, but the tools that I got to help me become a better parent. And it was really wonderful quality education. That's why I'm a firm believer and always have been of not just early childhood education, but early childhood and family education. And as a city council member, I had the opportunity to and the pleasure of attending many adult basic education graduations. And trust me, you only have to attend one of those before you realize what a life-changing experience that can be in that student's life and then that adult's life. So today I have with me Lisa Green, the Director of Community Education for St. Louis Park School Districts. She will provide a brief testimony on what the increases to community education funding would mean to her district as well as others. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Chair Loon, and members of the committee. Again, my name is Lisa Green, and I am representing the Minnesota Community Education Association today in favor of House File 625 to increase community education general revenue funding. We call that the general community education levy in the field. And I want to thank you to Representative Joachim for introducing this bill and moving it forward. And I'm so glad that you had a great experience in community education. I think everybody who experiences it certainly does. You've already heard about what the general levy does, and you're going to hear more a little bit later about many of the different programs that we have, so I won't go into that. So I'll just talk a little bit about what this means in St. Louis Park. As Representative Joachim stated, the funding in 1987 to 2003 was $5.95 per person, and it has been since lowered now to $5.42 per person. So in St. Louis Park, that represents a decrease of $24,120 per year in actual revenue. But if you were to factor in inflation since 1987, that amount increases to approximately $102,000 of revenue that we don't have that we could have to operate our programs. So what this means for us in St. Louis Park, and I'd say probably most districts in the state, is that because most of our funding is based on staffing, we have less staff available to develop programming, to do community engagement, and to develop partnerships. And in order to cover the cost of our infrastructure, that is not covered by our community education levy. We have to charge higher fees in our community in order to cover the overhead for our administration and our support staff. And in St. Louis Park, this is becoming a problem due to our changing demographic. Like community education programs all around the state, we provide ourselves in offering high-quality programs at an affordable cost for our youngest learners, our early childhood learners and parents, to our senior citizens. And many of our families have tight budgets as they raise their children, and many of our senior citizens live on fixed incomes. So when we have to raise our fees, they feel it in their checkbooks. And in St. Louis Park, we have a growing low-income and immigrant population, and we are also exploring how we could better engage our residents. But with less supportive funding, we're finding it difficult to do the very time-consuming work of community outreach and then to also be able to create low-cost or free opportunities for this demographic. So to sum up, increasing our general community education levy would give us more ability to engage our communities and provide high-quality, affordable programming for our residents. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Green. Any questions for either the bill author, Representative Joaquin, or Ms. Green? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Isn't the statistic something like for every $1 invested in community education, there's like a $4 return?
Yes, there is. I'm not sure what the latest statistic is, but certainly because we can take the dollars and leverage them out in the community. But in order to do that, we need to have staff people that can spend the time to do that. So when we have less staff, it gets a little harder to start leveraging those dollars.
Representative Peterson? Other questions? All right. Not seeing any. We'll leave you with any final comments to your bill. House File 625 is amended.
Yes. Once again, I want to thank the committee for taking this under consideration, and I'll have to echo the return on investment comment Representative Peterson said. It does make a huge difference in the quality of society we all live in, and depending on which program you're looking at, when they did studies way back in 2003 when I was advocating for early childhood education in general, ECFB, you can get upwards of $1 to $15 return for every dollar. So depending on what program you're talking about, these programs really, really impact our communities, and it's been a really long time since they've had any increase in funding. So I hope you'll consider that as we move forward, and I'd be willing to change that number or do whatever we need to do to give these folks a better chance. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Joaquin. And with that, I would renew my motion that House File 625, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or further action at a later time. Thank you so much for being here. All right. So now I'm going to turn back to nonpartisan staff to continue their overview, and they have gone to a lot of effort to put together some materials. So, again, we all have a good baseline knowledge of programs that fall under the community ed umbrella. And then after that, we'll go back to testimony. So, Representative, or Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, members, in the separate pack you have in front of you, there's a single sheet for each of the programs we're going to talk about, followed by a district-by-district printout of that program. The sheets are, look like those pages from yesterday, where the first top half of the sheet will discuss the revenue and the way the revenue is calculated, and the bottom half of the sheet will talk about how the money must be spent. The first printout and sheet then to look at is the rest of the community education revenue program. The landscape printout that was in the file for Representative Joaquin's bill shows the effect of a change based on the total system. The portrait style printout here is a baseline printout for fiscal year 19 and shows each of the components of the community ed formula. There's the basic revenue at $5.42 per capita. You can see in the second data column that raises $29.78 million. There's an extra dollar for each school district that operates a youth service program. That dollar times the per capita totals $5.3 million for the state. School districts may also offer an after-school enrichment program, and the revenue formula for this program is a two-part formula. For the first 10,000 residents of the district, the formula is $1.85 times each of those first 10,000 residents of the community, and then 43 cents for each resident after that. So it tends to skew the money just slightly on a per pupil basis to the smaller districts, and you can see $5.03 million in the after-school enrichment column. The total of all of those, then, is the $40.1 million of community ed revenue for fiscal year 19, and broken between the levy and aid, you can see that the fixed levy of 0.0094% raises nearly all the money through the levy, except for the very property-poor districts, which get a little bit of state aid under the program, and you can see that totals about $374,000 statewide. Most of the districts don't receive any aid under the basic or under the general community education formula. In a nutshell, Madam Chair, the expenditures for the community ed fund are in a reserved account. That means they can only be spent for community ed purposes. They can't be moved elsewhere. And those monies have to be spent according to the plan that the district has adopted. The community education plan often addresses issues like the overall catalog of events, school-age child care programs, adults with disabilities programs, the youth service, and the after-school enrichment activities. So, Madam Chair, that's the community education.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Strom. Any questions for Mr. Strom on those materials or figures? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Strom, the community education population, review what that is again, the number of...
Madam Chair, that's the per capita, the number of residents all ages that are located within the school district boundary. And then there's one little twist to that. If you're a very small school district, you're guaranteed a minimum population of 1,335 residents, regardless how small your community is. But it's people of all ages within the district.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? All right, then I think we'll move on to the next one.
Okay, Madam Chair, the youth development revenue was part of that program. The adults with disabilities program, there's a separate levy sheet, aid and levy sheet for that program in your packet. The adults with disabilities is a very limited revenue source. Only the districts that were approved a substantial number of years ago are allowed to participate in it because the overall revenue is fixed for the program. You can see that the levy for taxes payable in 2018, those were the levies that were just certified this last fall, totals $668,000. There's 62 school districts that have access to that. The maximum levy that any district can have is $30,000, and essentially, the full amount of levy authority has been allocated for 20-plus years under this program, under the revenue part of this program. There's also a matching state aid column, which is the far-right column on the printout, and you can see that totals about $710,000. That aid is directed to 37 districts. Part of that is because some of the districts offer their program in combination. But essentially a very small amount of revenue for the Adults with Disabilities program. I believe many community ed programs contain an Adults with Disabilities programming option, even though they don't get the specific revenue set aside for that program.
Thank you. And Mr. Strom, so you said this program hasn't really been changed or the funding stream because it's fixed for 20 years?
Madam Chair, at least 20. It may be more like 30 years. There was a very small addition. The reason the aid and the levy amounts don't equal each other is a few districts a number of years ago were given the aid even though there was no levy authority for them, and aid got grandfathered at that higher level. But other than that, there's been no change. Districts don't reapply each year. It's just those that were in continue to stay in the program.
All right, and then so the districts that are in are those that applied to be in it at the time?
Initially, yes, Madam Chair. Right. And I'm not sure if there was a priority list or first come, first serve, or what the initial allocation was based on.
Thank you. Representative Peterson.
Thanks. Sorry to be annoying today. So looking at this spreadsheet, and two of the school districts I represent, which is 181 and 184, had a 2018 levy, but they don't in 2019. And I don't know if you can explain why, or if potentially since they utilize District 917 services in intermediate district, if that maybe would have affected that.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, my headers probably should have been a little clearer, but the levy column is the middle one. Pay 18 levy goes with fiscal year 19. So they're a district that has some levy authority, but the aid for them, I believe, is all paid to one of the districts. I'm not sure which it is, but they each do their individual levying of the $30,000 that was available for their program, which is why those levy amounts are so small. And then one of the districts, the host district, gets the $30,000 in state aid for that program. But so the right-hand column is the state aid that goes with the same year as the Pay 18 levy. But I can look at my notes when I get back to my office and see if I can determine which other districts Burnsville's involved with. But I think if you were to add those districts together, it may be all the members of 917, if you add those together, you'll probably get the $30,000 of levy authority. And I'm not sure which district's acting as the fiscal host that gets the $30,000 of aid to go with that.
Other questions? All right. We'll go on to the next one.
Madam Chair, the next program's called developmental screening, sometimes referred to as health and developmental screening. There's not a printout for it, but there's a single sheet with a table. So if you'll turn to the single sheet that talks about developmental screening, this may come up in a couple of contexts this year. The screening program's primarily designed to help districts identify early whether, in addition to the child find identification of students, whether there are any delays or developmental reasons that a child should receive early educational screening. And as a result, the incentive is for districts to screen students sooner rather than later. So if you look at the revenue table in the middle part of the page there, school districts that screen 3-year-olds receive $75 for each 3-year-old that goes through the screening. When the child turns 4, if the district screens that child when the child is 4 years old, they receive $50 as reimbursement per child screened. And then if that screening happens before the start of school for children aged 5 and 6, it's worth $40 to the district for the screening. And once they're enrolled in the school and still need screening, it's $30 per student screened. And you can see the number of children screened on the top line there. The 27,000 are screened at the age of 3 and another 23,000 at age 4, and significantly more than those that are screened at 5 and 6. So most of the students are getting caught at the age of 3 or 4 for the screening. You can see the total revenue then by category for each of those categories screened, and the bottom line there at about $3.7 million for the program for the years. There's been a number of conversations about the program over the year, and some legislators have been interested in it focusing on the developmental side. Representative Erickson may want to address that a bit, but there's the header in statute still refers to health and developmental screening, but the program's really focused on developmental screening.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. And so this is separate from the topic of kindergarten readiness screening,
yeah.
Correct?
Madam Chair, yes. This includes things like the hearing and vision screening, basic measurements of the child's height and weight, identification of risk factors, and some of sort of the more developmentally appropriate measures for children to see how their physical coordination is and all of that kind of thing.
All right. And Mr. Shum, so the screening, is it generally done by community ed, maybe with their preschool program or early childhood educators? Because I note in here it says if there's a difference in what the aid covers and the cost of the program for district than the general fund of the school district, I'm assuming, is used to make up for that shortfall?
Yeah, Madam Chair, the screening is mandatory for the district to perform. So whether or not that aid is sufficient to cover their costs, the district is required to perform the screening. In terms of the models that are used, perhaps some of today's testifiers could address very quickly in their district how that works when they come up elsewise. I'm familiar with the model where the community ed program runs that in larger districts. Often that's run not just at one time in the year, but throughout the year at various times, and different school personnel are used to do that. Often the program will include volunteers to help, and sometimes private and other public officials like public health nurses may be involved in the screening as well.
Thank you. Representative Gaffney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Strom, you refer to districts doing this, but under state law, charters are districts. How do they interact with this responsibility?
Mr. Strom.
I don't think I've gotten that face from him before.
We have stumped our nonpartisan. I didn't think this would ever happen.
My work here is done.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members, we have a bit of an issue sometimes with the statutes, and I guess I'm not sure on the way that the charter schools are doing screening. The mandate, of course, is on the school district for their resident children to do that screening. Others are encouraged. The screening can help elsewhere, can happen elsewhere, so others are encouraged to do that screening. And I would suspect charter schools that are serving a younger population, if they're receiving children that haven't received a screening elsewhere, may do that screening. But it's not limited only to school districts doing it, is my understanding. I think the reimbursement would go to a charter. To the extent that most charters aren't serving four-year-olds and most of the children screened are 3- and 4-year-olds, I would guess that there are relatively few charters that are doing the screening. One other thing to point out about that screening, that's where the initial MARS number is generally assigned to a non-special ed child that's often their first contact with the system. So often that MARS number then originates with that original screening. I'll double check on the charter role there and the payments, whether there's payments to the charters for that. But I believe there is. I'll double check.
Thank you, Mr. Strong. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Peterson.
Thank you. When you mentioned the MARS training, if your child is involved in ECFE and really that is the first point of contact, are they assigned a MARS number at that point?
Madam Chair, I'll double check on this too. I don't think they usually are when they're involved with ECFE. I'm not positive about that. One of the district experts might be able to tell us. I tend to think of if the child's non-special ed, so that they're not in the child find system, I tend to think of the screening as their initial entry point into the MARS system. But the experts from the districts could sure tell you right offhand what their policy on that is.
Right, and they will be testifying, so I'm sure they're listening and will offer comments. Representative Scott.
Just another acronym. I'd like the explanation for.
Oh, yes. I'm so sorry, Madam Chair. Representative Scott, in the school funding world, the pupil accounting system is referred to as MARS, the Minnesota, Automated Reporting Student System. And that system handles all of the pupil accounting work for the department. But it tracks the children from district to district using an identification number that's assigned with that child's first entry into the school. So if a child first has exposure to the public school system in Anoka, for example, that MARS number would have the Anoka district code as well as the student number that's assigned to it, and that number follows that student all the way through to graduation.
Thank you.
Other questions? All right. Next program you want to talk about.
Madam Chair, the next program that this committee is quite familiar with, given the discussions of all the early education programs over the last few years, is the Early Childhood Family Education Program. There's two parts to this program, and it looks like I printed off a copy of the printout without the last column on it. The basic ECFE formula is set at 2.3% of the formula allowance, which for fiscal year 19 is $145.18. And just because every program needs a separate pupil count, this one actually keys off the resident number of students ages 0 to 5 within each district. And there, if you look at the printout, you can see there's about 360,000 students of that age, or children of that age from birth to up through the end of age 4. The revenue is simply that allowance, the $145.18 for fiscal year 19 times that pupil count. And so you can see from the printout that there's $53 million of ECFE revenue. The levy for this program set at whatever rate each year raises $22.135 million, and the remainder then comes in state aid. So unlike the community ed program, which is almost entirely levy now, the ECFE program is a mix of aid and levy where about three-fifths of the money comes from the state aid. There's another column that should have been here that I somehow left off, and that's the one additional part of the ECFE program is the home visiting revenue, and that's $3 per 0 to 5 year old in the population of the district, and that's set aside for the home visiting programs that school districts can do.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, did Mr. Strom say 0 to 5 for that one for home visit?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, very quickly, the last program then is has a descriptor sheet, and it tries to compile the data for each of the adult basic education programs onto the printout. School districts form consortiums with other school district and community providers of services, including nonprofits and higher education institutions, and offer adult basic education services. Those services are for teaching people basic literacy skills, for helping them with getting adult diplomas, or equivalency certificates such as the GED. And the consortiums also are required to work with workforce development centers to try and make sure that the skills that folks need are also skills that they'll use in the work environment. ABE program can teach, in addition to the literacy and the skills enhancement, can have programs set aside for citizenship preparation and civics education as well. There's 40-some consortiums in the state or approved providers of ABE programs. Those that are in consortia get a different level of funding than those outside of the consortium, and you'll be hearing about that a bit today. Just very quickly, in the revenue columns, the estimated entitlement for fiscal year 18 was about $47 million, and that's broken down into several parts of the formula. The single biggest is in the middle of the sheet. Districts receive for this year $6, a little over $6 per hour of contact time with adults taking the ABE courses. There were 5.3 million contact hours reported for FY18, and that times the $6.05 is about $31.9 million that's distributed on the contact hours basis. And then there are three other categories of revenue. The census aid entitlement is provided at $1.73 for the current year. So if you look at the census of each of those consortia, take that number times the $1.73, and that's the amount of census aid entitlement the district gets. And then two other categories at the end, the English learner count at $44 for each English learner in the count. The 68,000 English learners reported there generate about $3 million for the English learner programs. And then finally, there's a count for that's taken off of census data. That's the count of folks age 25 or older who do not have a high school diploma, and About $8 times that count is distributed for the no diploma category. If you look at the printout, you can see that those districts that are not members of a consortium will have zeros in every column but the contact hour column, and there's been some bills in the past few years about the arrangement for those districts. For each of the consortia, we have data broken down by the individual members so one can see the characteristics of the members of each of the school district members of each consortium. But in general, the programs are offered by usually together by more than one district and with other community partners for the adult literacy efforts.
Well, thank you, Mr. Strom. And so for like the English learner count, and that's actually for people enrolled in an ABE program, or is it based on population characteristics?
Madam Chair, I need to confirm this, but that count looks to me very similar to the count of the school district wide count statewide. So I believe it's the school district for all the member school districts of each consortium. I believe that's the count, the proxy variable that's used for the English learner count. I don't think it's based on participation. And then that amount, pardon me, is multiplied by that $44. And the dollar value of each of these formulas is actually backed into through a series of formulas in statute. But I think it's easier sometimes to describe these as the dollars that each of those categories generates.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Strom. Representative Devney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Strom, I'm looking for that face again. I'm noticing it was the third largest, and now I've lost it, but the third largest recipient of state aid under ABE is the Department of Corrections. Yeah. However, we have them with a zero census count. But my understanding is under Minnesota law, for the purposes of things like redistricting at least, prisoners are identified as where they are imprisoned. So they actually are there for census purposes. But they don't get their residency doesn't get recognized for the purposes of this aid. And I'm just trying to understand the connection between those two, because it seems like there's a mismatch in state aid or in state policy.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Daphne, the census count here is also serving essentially as a proxy variable, just like the English learner count is not those served by the program but of the school district members. The census count is determined the same way. It's the census, the residents within each school district that's a member of each consortium. And because the Department of Corrections isn't in a consortium, there's essentially no territory assigned to them separately with a census count. So the Department of Corrections, for example, maybe the facility in Stillwater, for example, would not be counting any of the Stillwater population. That Stillwater population would be counting in the whatever consortium the Stillwater School District is a part of for its adult basic learning. The issue with, if you look at the list with those and zeros in the census, those are the programs that are essentially outside of consortiums in terms of how their funding works. And so it's these three funding sources other than the contact hours are only available to those that are members of consortium. And I'm not sure, I get the sense that this isn't a very satisfactory answer for you, but it's essentially a proxy variable that's in the formula to determine services, and it's not suggesting that there are zero people there or that the residents are being counted somewhere else that are in the correctional system.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So a million years ago, I proctored GED tests out at the Hennepin County Workhouse as an employee of whatever the West Metro ABE consortium was. So there, the workhouse, I don't believe they call them inmates, but guys, were getting services through that consortium. It sounds like the prison system does not participate in the consortiums. They provide the services themselves. But in this case, the consortium Stillwater is a part of gets more state aid than they actually would provide services for, because the prison population is counted as part of the eligible census count for their consortia, but they're not delivering services to that portion of that census. I'm not sure I'm getting this question right, but I think you know what I'm asking.
Madam Chair, Representative Daphne, how eloquent of me to say yeah. I think the issue, as you state, there's no population associated with the corrections. And part of that, and the ABE folks, when they speak, may want to address this. This formula was a series of compromises mm-hmm. worked out about 20 years ago, and prior to that time, there was a big there was a much different formula, and back in the 80s, Representative Bowerly and others were interested in reworking that. And one of the big units involved at the time was the Department of Corrections, and because a lot of the folks in the correctional institutions did not have a high school education. And so when the formula was created, there was an explicit recognition that the Department of Corrections would continue to provide services, adult basic education services. And so the formula knew at the time that there wasn't going to be any population assigned to the Department of Corrections because of the way that the design works. As to the second part of that, the local jails and workhouses and things, those I think are generally done through the consortiums. But the Department of Corrections would be dealing with the state with the state population that's in the prisons, and I'm not sure if the Department of Corrections works with others or not in their to deliver those services. That's an area that I'm sure that the experts from ABE can tell us all about.
All right, thank you. Appreciate it,
Representative Dabney. All right, any other questions? And I think we've gone through all the sheets now. All right. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At the bottom of ABE expenditures in that last paragraph, it notes the activities for which ABE aid can be used. Have we ever gotten a report on that? Breakdown, Mr. Strong?
Madam Chair, there's a whole process that the ABE folks use for their reporting. I think it's primarily a federally driven process, but they report on their outcomes, and I would guess that as a part of that process, they probably list the numbers in each of these categories that they're serving, that they probably identify the specific services that they're providing. I'm not familiar with that, but I'm sure the ABE folks are.
Thank you.
All right. So with that, I think we'll go ahead and invite our testifiers to come down. I know we've got Kia Brown, Director of Community Ed for District 196, and we'll discuss and maybe be able to offer some comments on some of the questions that have been raised. While she's coming down, do we have any other students that came in after introductions? I want to make sure we recognize all of our students. Representative Crescia.
I have one with me, a gentleman who's shadowing me, and I'm going to make sure I get the name right, so I'm going to read it right off the name tag. Mason Schooner. All right. I practiced that on the elevator all the way down.
Well, welcome. We're always happy to have students with us. Thanks for being here. Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have with me, and the name is a little easier to pronounce, Bethany Jansen, shadowing me today.
All right. Welcome, Bethany. All right. Thank you. Anybody else that we missed? Yes.
Logan. Is shadowing me.
Welcome, Logan. Great. Great to have you. Thank you so much. All right. Got everybody? All right. Oh, Representative Mariani. Welcome. Thank you. Thanks, Gabby. Thanks for being here. All right. Okay. So let's hear from Ms. Brown, again, Director of Community Ed from District 196.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kaya Brown. I'm the Director of Community Education for the Rosemount Apple Valley Eakin School District, and I also represent the Minnesota Community Education Association. Thank you all for this opportunity to share with you and the committee about the excellent work happening across Minnesota in our community education programs. And I just want to recognize the other community education professionals that are here today, and I'm sure that they would be happy to answer any questions you may have after our testimony. Community education has established a proven statewide school-based network and delivery system of programs and services designed to provide universal access for the youngest to the oldest Minnesotans for nearly 50 years. Today, I plan to share information about just four of our community education programs to give you a deeper sense of the opportunities available to your constituents with the assistance of state aid and or local levy. The first program I'd like to highlight are our youth programs, which ensure K-12 learners have access to quality out-of-school time academic, enrichment, youth development, community service, and after-school care opportunities. The after-school enrichment levy provides the capacity for community education to offer after-school, release day, and summer programming, while the youth development levy focuses on building youth leadership that equips today's youth to be effective, involved, and positively impactful leaders in their communities, and creates community service opportunities. The school age care program provides care and education for children before and after school as well as summer. This program also assists in offering a safe and nurturing environment that is staffed by educated and experienced professionals who focus on the social, emotional, physical, and intellectual development of each child. These programs provide a robust menu of options for families and students to expand their skills and interests in a safe environment and supports family and student needs. The research is clear that there are many important outcomes for children who are engaged in these programs. Children have better emotional adjustment and connection to school and community. They have more positive self-perceptions and social behaviors. According to an After School Alliance 2016 report, students in high-quality after-school programs are more engaged in school and have better attendance, behavior, grades, and test scores, work habits, and increase their likelihood of moving on to the next grade level and graduating. Having after-school choices helps parents keep their jobs, helps students succeed, and helps ensure businesses can hire the local workforce they need to thrive. After-school programs not only have a positive effect on students at risk of failure, but help reduce the achievement gap between students from lower and high-income families. And for every dollar invested in after-school programs, $2.50 is saved in crime-related costs because children engage less in drug and alcohol or sexual risk-taking as well as other negative behaviors. One student from Roseville Area School states, "As a student of color at a school with little diversity in my school, it was sometimes hard to find where I fit in. The school-age care program was that place. I was always welcomed, and everyone genuinely cared about me. Friendship Connection became my after-school family." Funding for youth programs has been flat for 15 years since 2003. A combination of inflationary erosion, the cost of high-quality programming, and a significant increase in the number of families who cannot afford to pay has resulted in lost opportunities for students most in need of these programs. In Roseville area schools, they have looked for ways to braid programs and funding opportunities together for student success. And I'd like to tell you about a student named Naya and her summer experience as an example. 1 week after school is out, Naya starts Kaleidoscope Summer School, which is funded under alternative education dollars or targeted services. Her parents drop her off in the morning at Friendship Connection School Age Care Program. She has breakfast at school, attends hands-on classes in the morning of her choice, such as swimming lessons, arts, engineering, dance, or others, or she might be involved in their 21st Century Learning Center program, such as the Leaders in Training Academy. Naya then has lunch and finishes her day back at Friendship Connection School Age Care. When summer school is over, she has additional activities she can choose from for the remainder of the summer. Naya's family would not have been able to sign her up for all these activities without the support of levies and scholarship dollars. Naya's mom states, "As a working mom with two jobs, I do not know what I would have done without these programs. I can go to work and know that Naya is safe, she is learning, and she is cared for. I can tell how much the staff care about her, and most importantly, they really listen to her." Students and families see that the Roseville Area Schools Community Education Department provides a variety of programming opportunities with high-quality activities and financial support to families in need. These opportunities happen when a variety of funding sources can be braided together, such as youth enrichment budget, the youth development levy, youth service levy, community education levy, targeted services funding, 21st Century Learning Grant funding, school age care, summer feeding program, and the school district transportation budget. Even with all these funding sources, Roseville Community Ed can fall short in revenue when working in a building with 74% of students living in poverty. Next, I'd like to share about early childhood family education, also known as ECFE. Research shows that education begins in the home, and a strong start for every learner begins with parent education to assist and empower parents in their role as their child's first and primary teacher. Early childhood family education provides quality programming, including research-based content and practice, parent and community involvement, professional and licensed staff, and links to elementary education efforts. Through community needs assessments that are completed at the local level, parent educators identify specific topics to address special concerns of families, such as single parenting, teen parenting, and children with special needs. There is a myth out there that early childhood family education serves mostly white, well-to-do, stay-at-home moms. And indeed, we do serve this demographic because ECFE serves parents of every demographic. In Rosemont Apple Valley Eagan, 36% of our ECFE program participants are considered to be living in poverty, and we specifically offer programs for families at risk. In Columbia Heights, 80% of participants in ECFE qualify for free or reduced lunch rates. 28% are receiving early childhood special education services, and 68% are English learners. All of those demographics are higher than the K-12 rates for that district. One example of targeted programming is a collaboration with our local Head Start to provide parent education to parents participating in their program. To meet the family's needs, we offer parent education through a variety of methods, including weekly parent ed classes, individual parent meetings, phone calls, and family nights. Additionally, Rosemont Apple Valley Eagan offers parent education at Dakota Woodlands in Eagan, which is a shelter for homeless women and families. Families stay at the facility anywhere from a few days up to 6 months. During their stay at Dakota Woodlands, parents participate in a parent education program where licensed parent educators facilitate adults in conversation to understand the importance of parenting their children at different stages of their child's life. Again, parents choose the topics they want to discuss, which may include communication with their child, discipline, trust, sleep, stress, and much more. The parent educators also continually discuss the importance of reading to their child and how it builds their vocabulary, gets them ready to read, and provides the one-on-one time with their children. From self-reporting and questions asked, there is a definite growth and better understanding about parenting. Some participant statements include, "I stop and wonder why I'm doing X. I have stopped smoking after we talked about how secondhand smoke can damage my child's health. I have better boundaries with my children." One of our better known sub-programs of early childhood family ed is our district's family literacy program, which we call Family School. It is a collaboration with our adult basic education program where parents attend the ABE program to improve their English speaking and writing skills or to obtain their GED or diploma. During this time, their children receive a preschool experience. One day each week, the parents participate in a parent education program where they not only gain valuable knowledge in parenting, but also learn how to assist their children in their school experience. Dad's classes are also a component of our ECFE program and are always well received by filling immediately. The dads receive parent education specific to their needs, build strong relationships with their child and other dads, as well as learn from one another. There are times when families of young children aren't able to come to the school district facility or the family has a new baby. Home visiting by an early childhood teacher or parent educator provides outreach and support to families who are homebound. The home visitor often receives the referrals by public health nurses, other teachers, or by daycare providers who recognize that a family needs individual support or has barriers to being able to come to an ECFE class. Home visitors can also provide an introduction to the school district and early childhood program to new parents. The goal of these visits is to provide community-based, accessible, and culturally relevant support that is individualized to meet the parents' needs with limited visits and to connect the family to ECFE classes or other services. Another very important part of our early childhood work is our early childhood screening program. Trained screeners typically spend more time with the children and parents than is afforded in a doctor's visit, and the information collected is used to support the unique needs of that child. Children 3 to 5 years old are screened for developmental and health-related concerns that could result in identification and follow-up of special needs. Inclusive communities are healthy communities. Adults with disabilities programs are designed to serve adults with physical, developmental, or cognitive disabilities by encouraging inclusion in the community and providing educational, social, recreational opportunities for participants. There are adults with disabilities living in every community in every part of our state. Over 82,000 vulnerable adults receive services and support through community ed every year. This reflects just a small portion of the need. Classes help to increase life skills such as hygiene, money management, cooking, and personal safety, and activities provide an opportunity for participants to be a part of the community. Rosemount Apple Valley Eagan is a member of a consortium along with the Burnsville, Farmington, Lakeville, and Randolph school districts. Each season that our catalog of classes is distributed, classes fill nearly immediately. This speaks not only to the quality of the program, but also to the need for those opportunities in our community. In most cases, Community Education's Adults with Disabilities program is the only place for vulnerable adults to participate in activities with their peers and in the community. Unfortunately, though, we cannot offer enough programming to meet the need. As you heard earlier, funding for the Adults with Disabilities program has been flat for 29 years since its inception in 1989. That funding serves only the 37 programs in existence when the statute first passed in 1989. Maintaining services is becoming more difficult each year, and many districts are unable to offer this program because the cost of transportation, staffing, and services has increased. This strain is particularly apparent in rural areas without access to public transportation. In our consortium of five districts, we receive a little over $13,000 in state aid to provide programming for over 12,000 participants. That's just over a dollar for each registration each year. As a result of this limited funding, each of our five consortium districts have chosen to use money from our General Community Education Fund to help support the program for an additional $53,000, which increases the total for each registration to over $5. We are able to do our best with two part-time staff and the reliance of volunteers to support these classes, activities, and participants. Additionally, these vulnerable adults are also typically on a fixed income. Therefore, fees need to remain low in order for their participation in the community, as many of them have less than $100 each month to spend on activities, entertainment, clothing, and other necessities. Two testimonials from parents of adults in the Adults with Disabilities program include, Kelsey has really come out of her shell and become much more social due to attending many of the classes. Through cooking classes, Kelsey has gained many cooking and organizational skills, which have taught her how to take more responsibility in other daily living tasks. Through Project Explore, she has gained valuable skills moving her toward greater independence. Also, my son needs full-time staff and redirection to stay sage and appropriate. Going out in the community with one staff or parent can be challenging due to his behaviors, which can be inappropriate or misunderstood. He is not always welcomed or accepted out in the community, as some individuals have little or no experience or understanding of someone who has autism. Others appear to have very little patience. While he still needs full-time staff and some redirection, Project Explore has been an enormous gift to him, his family, and his group home. How great to have an activity or event two or three times a week where he can be successful and gain pure enjoyment with friends while being fully welcomed and accepted. Without this program, his opportunities for socialization on the community would be none. Project Explore gives me and my husband comfort that once we are gone, our son will continue to have opportunities for a fuller, richer life. In conclusion, community education programs are vital to Minnesota's future. This statewide school-based network connects local people and resources to improve schools and communities. We operate efficiently and look to innovate as we build relationships and support learning in our communities. Thank you again for providing this opportunity and allowing us to share briefly our work.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Brown. It was a very, very good and very thorough breakdown of all the good work that you're doing in your community with Community Ed. So other questions for Representative Willis?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And
I just want to say thank you, Ms. Brown, for coming today and sharing the work that you do. I've had the opportunity to attend some of the graduation ceremonies that District 196 has had for adults who have gone through and gotten their diploma or GED. And I have a couple questions for you.
Sure.
But one question I had was for District 196, this is the fourth largest district in the state, just to give us an idea, how many graduates or individuals who get GEDs do you have each year, roughly?
Okay, so we are a consortium of one, and we have a little over 100 graduates each year. Granted, not all of them do the walk, but over 100 each year. Yes.
Representative Wells.
And thank you, Madam Chair. So I think that's helpful to know, and I really appreciate that District 196, and I'm sure other districts do this too, really recognize their efforts and that they're following through on those efforts. So thank you for that. And then I did have a question about the developmental screening. You talked a little bit about it, and I don't know if you would know the answer, but as part of the screening, do you know if sensory disorders are screened for at that level, or is that looked at a different time?
I personally do not know because, I'm sorry,
that's right.
Because Community Education 196 does not run the screening program. We are the fiscal agent. But is someone else? No? No.
Perhaps someone from the district could get back to the committee on that, Representative Wills.
That would be helpful. I just want to know if that's being identified at that early stage and if it's not being in one of the items on the list or being screened for, is that something that maybe we could add?
Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Brown? Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Brown, thank you. It indeed was very thorough. And give us a good flavor for or sense for the incredible breadth of scope of work that's happening in your community. It sounds like there was it's probably the culmination of many, many years of thinking carefully through what your community aspires to and also needs and how to meet those needs. One of the things that I think about relative to the professionals that do this work is that I think they often get lost, as we think about other professionals in the broader education arena, whether, it's regular classroom teachers, which, would be the bulk of that, or administrators. And so this question is not so much, it certainly isn't about pitting, the professionals you're talking about relative to them. They all do phenomenal work. But I do think that we tend to forget about those professionals. And so I'm just wondering if you could share a little bit with us about what the level of satisfaction is among those professionals. What are some of the issues that concern them? I would think that pay would be something that's important for them. I'm kind of guessing that we're not necessarily talking about folks that are, making, market rate, pay, but I'm guessing. And so whatever you're willing to share at this point would
sure.
be helpful.
Well, I can say I can say that I probably work in one of the best school districts in the state of Minnesota, and we are very grateful. We talk about how we feel like a family and we enjoy coming to work. Only speaking for 196, I would say that the level of satisfaction of staff is quite high. We enjoy what we do, and we enjoy coming to work and getting to do what we do on a daily basis. In terms of pay, we follow whatever the district guidelines are. Depending upon what area that you're working in, that may be an entry-level job where you are making minimum wage and can work up. But for those of us who are salaried, we are being paid at the same level as other district staff are being paid. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so.
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, I have a bill that it touches on this issue. So part of this is sort of trying to tee that up. But, sure. My understanding is that that's going to be different from perhaps from school district to school district, and you've already prefaced and caveated you know you work for the best school district, so there you go. But I think part of the issue is that many of those professionals don't get to sit in on the decisions, you know, relative to budgeting and contract negotiations, you know, that that do have a direct impact. So they're kind of waiting for other folks to make those decisions without them in the room. Is that a fair characterization?
I would say that is fair.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for the work you do.
Thank you.
All your colleagues as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. If there are no other questions, thank you very much, Ms. Brown. We very much appreciate you being here. And again, thanks for all the good work that is clearly going on in District 196 with our community ed programs.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right, so, okay, so now we've got some testifiers on adult basic education. And I have that Sherry Munyon with Literacy Action Network wanted to testify. Or others testify. Okay, so come on down. All right, welcome. And to each of you, if you would just give us your name before you provide your testimony so we can be sure to get that for the record.
My name is Tom Citrin Heistam, and I represent Literacy Action Network, which is the statewide adult basic education professional network. And with me are...
Hi, my name is Kelly McGowan, and I'm the director of adult basic education for Metro South, which is a consortium of Bloomington, Eden Prairie, Edina, and Richfield.
Thank you. Nice to see you again, Ms. McGowan.
Nice to see you, too. Thank you.
Welcome.
I'm Jane Grotman, and I'm the executive director of the International Institute of Minnesota. We're a nonprofit in St. Paul that serves new Americans.
Very good. Well, thanks all for being here, and whoever would like to lead off.
Madam Chair, city members, thank you so much for the opportunity to talk a little bit more in depth about ABE than we sometimes have the time to, but we won't go on for a real long time, don't we? A lot of what I was going to say, I mean, I have three things I wanted to talk about is a brief overview of ABE, which the committee staff has already done very well, so I won't say too much about that. So a little bit about the ABE formula and
Could you move the microphone a little closer to you?
Sure.
Thank you.
A little bit about the ABE formula and our current funding needs and some of the current, highlighting a few of the current challenges within the ABE field. So the first area having to do with ABE, I wanted to respond to a couple of questions I think earlier. I believe somebody had asked about the number of students that serve, that receive different sorts of services. In one of the handouts we provided, there's a breakdown by that, and it shows that 17% were GED or adult diploma college prep students, 56% were English language learners, basic skills were 26%, and then other such as civics and just civics and so on were 1%. I believe there was another question about outcomes and accountability, and we have a very comprehensive accountability system that is pretty much mandated by the Fed since we got a small amount of federal funding. And we keep extremely detailed records on each learner. We have requirements about pre-testing, post-testing, personal education plans, tracking their progress, follow-ups at certain periods of time after they leave the program to see how many people are employed in future quarters, how many people are in college, how they're doing, and so on. So the Department of Education, ABE Department, can provide very detailed reports on all of that if you're interested in that. I wanted to talk, too, about there are somebody mentioned 44 consortia around the state. The vast majority of those are school district-based, although they often have community-based organizations as members. And then there are a couple of community-based organizations who have chosen to form their own consortia apart from school districts. And we try very hard to serve all areas of the state with a good level of access in terms of rural, suburban, and urban areas in the state. Somebody had inquired about, I believe, the Department of Corrections. And my memory, I was on the original task force in 1999 that helped devise the suggestions we sent to the legislature, which formed the basis of legislation. And the sense was the Department of Corrections was kind of a separate case. They have kind of a, so to speak, captive population, so they have very high attendance because it's part of the many of the prisoners' plan. They don't have people not just not coming to class, which is so often the case in community locations. So they are able to generate a fairly large amount of revenue through their contact hour funding as opposed to the base funding that the school district consortia receive. So I believe, to the best of my memory, that was the reason why that happened. I have not heard. We work very closely with the Department of Corrections that works in the prisons, and I have not heard any funding complaints from them that they are not receiving adequate funding. I also wanted to mention one of the things we're very proud of in Adult Basic Ed is that we try to be very creative and nimble and react to changing circumstances as they occur in the state. Three examples that I would cite. First of all, we're doing a lot of work in the development of career pathways, which is preparing people with job skills to enter the labor market, and that has really taken off in the last number of years. Secondly, several years ago, there was a grant from the legislature to develop a volunteer navigator training program. There's been a lot of evidence from around the country that ADE students do much, much better when they have a navigator that can help them resolve some of the personal barriers they have, the challenges they have, provide tutoring sometimes if necessary, help them do career planning. That training is now just almost done, is being piloted, and will be rolled out around the state over the next year or two in terms of providing training volunteers to provide those kinds of navigation services. Third example I would say is that some of you may have heard of the North Star Digital Literacy Assessment Project. That was a project that grew out of a collaboration between the St. Paul Public Library and the St. Paul Consortium in 2012. And it developed into an online set of assessment modules for basic computer skills and digital literacy, which is now has been adopted. That's based on a set of standards we developed, has been adopted by the Department of Education as official ADE content standards, is used in about 130 locations throughout Minnesota, including all consortia, workforce centers, CBOs, as well as 38 other states and 3 foreign countries. So we're real proud of that. And that's just an example of the kind of work that we're able to do in a collaborative fashion. Talk real briefly about the formula. It was developed about 18, 19 years ago in a very bipartisan manner. The task force was charged with coming up with something that was as fair as we could possibly be to all parts of the state and that would provide a certain level of service everywhere. And that was why school districts were chosen as the facilitators or the main fiscal agents of those consortia because there are school districts in every geographic area of the state, and that made the most sense. I also want to mention, however, that there are approximately 20 community-based organizations, nonprofits throughout the state that also provide ADE services. In most cases, those CBOs are members, have chosen to be school members of school-based consortia. In a couple of instances, they've chosen to be independent. But whether they're part of a school district consortia or whether they are independent, they receive exactly the same level of funding, which is only the contact hour revenue. The three elements of the base aid go directly to the school district, and I'm not aware of any cases where those are being shared with CBOs. So I want to make that clear that we're all kind of in the same boat. In your packet, I believe there's a copy of a letter that has been signed by most of the consortia in the state, just strongly supporting the current funding system and the consortia mechanism that has been set up. Finally, on some of the current challenges, I'm sure you spent a lot of time dealing with the labor shortage in Minnesota. We have about 3% unemployment, and a huge issue for many, many employers is finding adequately skilled people. I tried yesterday Googling Minnesota labor shortage. I came up with articles on labor shortages in healthcare, in nursing, education, food system, food service, many, many areas. And the state demographer has said that because our population is not growing particularly fast, the only solution is to train and educate the people who are here now who could potentially be in the labor force, including immigrants and other people who are, for whatever reason, unemployed. And that's exactly what we do. So it's we believe that the labor shortage and the work that we do in response to that really offers an opportunity to diversify the workforce, to allow various minority communities to enter jobs that will help deal with the income gap, and to increase wages. That's only possible if we have funding to do recruitment training and support for those learners that are entering the various job skill training programs. Finally, I want to talk just for a minute about funding. The hourly contact hour rate in 2001 was $5.72 an hour. on at $6, this year at $6.01 per hour. If funding had kept up with the cumulative inflation rate during that time, those years, which was 38%, we would be at $7 to $8.9 an hour, and I don't think anybody would have any funding shortages. Unfortunately, that has not happened. There are some real consequences to that, however. The number of ADE teachers who are part-time has grown from two-thirds to three-fourths in recent years, and that's almost exclusively, not because they want to work part-time, but because there's just not funding to hire full-time benefit staff who can get full-time benefits and so on. The problem is, as we develop these career pathways, they tend to be very labor-intensive. They are sometimes smaller classes because you don't have as many people who want to learn to be certified nursing assistants at a given time. Smaller classes, so the contact hour revenue is less. The costs are more because it takes more recruitment, more navigation, and sometimes hiring very specifically skilled teachers that have skills in a particular career area to do the teaching. So we don't have a specific bill we're supporting at the moment. We would like over time to suggest that the current 3% growth factor, which is based on a rolling average of the past 10 years, be converted to a 3% annual growth, and that would enable us to keep up with inflation and continue to provide the high-quality services that we would like to do. That's the first plank of Literacy Action Network's platform. And then the second plank is that we are going to request a $150,000 one-time allocation to as a capital allocation to increase enhance the North Star Digital Literacy Assessment Project so that it keeps up with current technology and so on. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. McGowan?
Sure.
Yeah. I'm sorry, you'll just have to move either mic just so we can hear you clearly.
Hi. Thank you for letting me be here today. My name is Kelly McGowan, and I'm, again, the adult director. Ed Director for Metro South, which is a consortium of Bloomington, Edina, Eden Prairie, and Richfield. I have been with Metro South for over 28 years, and so as you can imagine, I've seen a lot of changes in adult basic education. Our main campus is in Bloomington, Minnesota, in the old Lincoln High School, if you're familiar with that. We also offer programming, mostly English as a second language programming, at Hennepin Technical College in Eden Prairie. In program year 16-17, we served 2,229 students with a total of 232,668 program hours. Our enrollment numbers for this year are consistent with 16-17, and our mission statement is to support the efforts of all adults who wish to improve their lives through literacy, education, career development, and lifelong learning. Some of our population demographics include 35% include Latino or Hispanic students, 35% are Black, which includes African American and African born natives, 18% are Asian, and 10% are Caucasian, which includes European born and U.S. born. To note, our students come from 63 different language backgrounds, so it gives you an idea of the complexity of what we're dealing with and what our teachers are dealing with. Our programming includes English language classes, distance learning, adult diploma, state standard adult diploma, GED prep, college prep, family literacy, which is collaboration with our early learning services, a program where parents learn English and attend parent education classes while their children attend preschool. We have a reading lab. We have Reading for Success classes. We have career pathway classes, which Tom talked a little bit about. Those include child development associate, nursing assistant prep, medical terminology, phlebotomy, construction, commercial driver's license, and that is in conjunction with our school district, so we are trying to train our students to also be school bus drivers within the district as well. And we also have an ESL and career development class. Last year, we awarded close to 100 diplomas and GEDs to students. We are fortunate that we were awarded a federally funded two-year civics grant of $100,000 per year. The money for our career development pathway classes. And this enables English language learners to become competent in the English language and prepare them for unsubsidized employment in in-demand industries. They're also learning essential skills to effectively function as parents, workers, and citizens in the United States. We are working in conjunction with the local workforce development system as well, and this is all informed by the WIOA mandate from the federal government. But we are very dependent on this grant to fund our career pathway programming. If we do not get the federally funded pathway programming money, I don't know if we're going to be able to continue with the career pathway program at the capacity that it's at right now. We are also fortunate to have an AmeriCorps VISTA opportunity navigator who supports our pathway programming, and we're in the fifth year of partnering with the Minnesota Opportunity Corps for that. Each year is different, but on average we serve the AmeriCorps VISTA serves 80 to 100 students with various career development strategies, resume writing, cover letters, mock interviews, helping them to fill out applications. And this has resulted in the 16-17 program year with 60 of our students completing job applications, 48 completing resumes, one completing a college application, 25 have gained employment, four have enjoyed volunteer experiences, and 29 have prepped for interviews. We also have, as Tom mentioned, our North Star Digital Literacy is one of the content standard areas that our students deliver in our curriculum and in our instruction. And we have an AmeriCorps VISTA Community Technology Empowerment Project person who's called a CTEP, who helps our students with digital literacy, who also helps our teachers with digital literacy. And the CTEP has been spending her service year assisting staff with integrating digital literacy standards and lessons, proctoring North Star digital literacy exams, hosting open lab hours for students, and recruiting and supporting volunteers to also help students practice and learn digital literacy skills so they are ready for the work world or post-secondary education when they're done with our programming at Metro South. We are also very fortunate to have a great volunteer staff. We owe a lot of gratitude to our amazing volunteers. In program year 16-17, we had over 100 volunteers who served in a variety of capacities, which included assisting classroom teachers in ESL, GED, and adult diploma. They also work one-on-one with students, and they lead classes at collaborative classrooms in our four consortium communities. Our volunteers last year contributed 4,963 hours, so they're a very dedicated group. 998 students received assistance from a volunteer during the 16-17 program year. Partners in our community include Normandale Community College, Hennepin Technical College, the Hennepin County Workforce Center, VEEP, which is a food shelf, Cornerstone, Hennepin County Library, CAPSH, and several more. Some of our challenges right now are dealing with, we're not exactly set up to deal with some of the mental health issues that adults bring with them to school. We don't have mental health counselors. A lot of our students have experienced trauma, have experienced some other life-changing experiences, and our teachers and staff are not set up to deal with counseling those students in those areas. Some of the students' stories and some of the testimonials, here's one from Nasib, who was born in Somalia, now an adult diploma. Her goal is to go to community college, and she is happy to learn English at Metro South. Natalia, born in the Ukraine, currently studying for a GED, and future plan to go to college and study psychology, but Metro South helped me with my English, so I have not changed their English, just so you can kind of get a better example of their experience.
Hello, I am Fernando. I'm from Mexico. I currently take ESL classes at Metro South Family School in Pond Building with my daughter Irene, who is in preschool. In future, I plan to open my business in order to have a better life for my family. I now can help my daughter do homework. Mark, born in Michigan. Right now I'm in the STAR program, which is a reading program for pre-GED students. He would like to work in retail in the future. Thank you for this program. Nobody has helped me before as much as you have. So I have several of these stacks of testimonials of the work that we have done. I have an amazing staff that works with me. They're dedicated professionals who go above and beyond, and I can't say enough about them. And I have truly enjoyed my experience in adult basic education, or I wouldn't have been here for over 28 years. So thank you for giving me the time to talk to you today. If you have any questions, please let me know.
All right. Thank you, Ms. McGowan. And to our third testifier, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm the executive director at the International Institute of Minnesota, which is a nonprofit in St. Paul that serves new Americans in our community. So last year we served over 4,000 new Americans, and we provide very comprehensive services, so beginning with basic needs support, housing, food support, and then immigration services, education, and workforce training programs. And last, in 2016, we actually got recognition from the Aspen Institute. They wrote up our work in one of their publications. And then also we were on the Federal Department of Labor's top 10 list for workforce training programs in the country. So we're very proud of that. So ABE is a critical part of that work. So ABE funding is an important part of our delivery system at the Institute and for all nonprofits that are doing this work. It both supports innovative work that Tom highlighted, and I'll highlight some, but it also allows us to sustain programming, and that's really key. The funding that is generated by student, the funding that we receive from ABE is generated by student contact hours in our classes, just to reiterate what Tom said. So at the Institute, you wouldn't be surprised to know that the ABE funding supports our English classes and our workforce training programs. This consistent and ongoing funding is key to the stability and the growth of our programs and helping us to leverage private funding in the community from foundations and such. We've worked very hard at the Institute to link our ABE English classes, where our students are building their very important foundational language skills, to our workforce training programs and our career pathways. So we have two pathways, our medical careers pathway and our hospitality careers pathways. Over the last two decades have employed more than 2,700 people. We've placed 2,100 nursing assistants in long-term care in the metro area, and almost 500 of them have become nurses, all of whom are working. Both of these pathways have an 85% placement rate, and the promise of pathways that work for students is a great motivator and really motivates people to continue their English language studies, but knowing that they can move into a pathway where they're going to become employed, and not only in their first job, but then there's a pathway that will move them along into a job that can pay $30 an hour if they make it into a nursing job, which many of them do. So out of this work, this pathway work that we've been doing for over two decades, we developed college readiness courses, courses that prepare students for the rigor of college with intensive reading, writing, and math. So these intensive free classes help students bypass developmental education, which is key to their success in college, as I'm sure you know. And from the students that enrolled and graduated from college readiness classes since 2015, over 90% of them were able to bypass developmental education and enroll in college. And this greatly increases retention and graduation rates in college. The national data, the local data, is, and the research is just everywhere right now, and it's really important to read that. If we can help people bypass that system and make it right into their college courses, it's going to really be key in their graduation rates. I mean, the research is really compelling. And we partner with St. Paul College, Normandale College, and Century College on that
program. And also just to add that many of these students that are bypassing DevEd and making it into their college classes are going into the healthcare profession. So not only does it help them support their families, but it's providing needed later labor in a sector that really needs employees. So lastly, I just wanted to say that we're very grateful for this funding. It's really helped us to sustain our programs and to grow our programs. But also just reiterate what Tom said, that it probably pays for about 60% of a full-time teacher's expenses. So it would really help if we could have an increase in the reimbursement rate. So thank you very much for this opportunity, and if I can provide any more information for you, I'm happy to do so. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much. I do think we've got at least one other person who wanted to testify on ABE, so I think what I'd like to do in the interest of time to have that person come down, and then we'll have questions of all of you after that. So if you want to maybe just sit behind and stay close, that would be great. David Gaither and Anicia Swan. Welcome, and if you would each just state your name for the record so we have that.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is David Gaither, and I am the Executive Director for the International Education Center, located at 12th and Harmon in downtown Minneapolis.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Anesia Swan, and I'm the Director of the Adult Basic Education Program with American Indian OIC in South Minneapolis.
Welcome to both of you.
Thank
Whoever
you.
Wants to start.
With that, just to give you a brief overview who IEC is, we serve an average of 600 to 700 students annually who come from over 60 different countries of origin and speak about 35 different native languages. 99% of our students are English language learners. The current student body is about 60% black, 24% Latino, 9% Asian, 6% white. Students range in age from 17 to 60 plus, with the largest percentage between the ages of 25 and 44. Our students' education background ranges from pre-literacy, meaning they've never held a pencil before, to postgraduate degrees from the country of origin. Our top four countries of origin are Somalia with 40% of our student body, Ethiopia with 10%, Ecuador with 8%, and Mexico with 6%. 65% of our students are at or below the poverty level, 44% are on state assistance. 25% of our students live in a homeless shelter. 30% of our students have post-secondary experience in the country of origin. 45% of our students have kids in the K-12 system here in Minnesota. 50% of our new students are referrals from current or former students. All of our students have unlimited linguist proficiency. If I could say it, it would be better. Over 90% of our students are over 25, and 50% of them are without a high school diploma. As you've heard in prior testimony, both from staff and others, that there are four variables in the education funding formula. We are our own fiscal agent and a standalone CBO. We receive contact hours and contact hours only for our efforts. The last time this formula was reviewed, Facebook hadn't been invented, there were no smartphones, and Barack Obama was the state senator from Illinois. We would really appreciate a review, an in-depth dive of the formula in and of itself. While I understand that it works for many and the work that all of us do is not without reward, there's significant psychic income that comes from doing the work that we do. But the population we serve and the areas we serve it in, we're being compensated at below market rates. And it's a sad dog that won't wag his own tail. So the report card that was referred to earlier, there's a couple of items in that well, we're quite proud of. One is that our level gains are that above average in the state. And we are probably number 4 or 5 in the state in terms of percentage of our population that achieve a job after they leave. In fact, there are people like Mark Zuckerberg who came to visit our school in the summer to meet with our students because of the work that we're doing. And his post on Facebook was the number one like post that Mark Zuckerberg had during that time of the year. The biggest challenge is the status quo. I'm coming here not today to offer problems. I'm here to offer solutions and my help to work out those solutions. Of the four variables in the funding formula, three of them pay for students who don't come to class. They're simply a function of the census. The only compensation we receive, another CBOs that are their own fiscal agent, is the number of hours of each student in the chair. I think it's inconsistent with legislative intent on the K-12 formula that money follows the students, and I think it's long overdue for a time for this review to be had and an honest and thorough and bright discussion be had on how we can do more with what we currently have. We'd certainly like to have more than we currently have, but I think we can do more and more effectively, and I think there are solutions to the problem that collaboratively and collectively we can address. This issue was addressed a couple years ago by a bipartisan group in the legislature. Many of the members of this committee were part of it, where they acknowledged that there was a discrepancy in the formula, and a one-time stopgap measure was put in place to provide us the opportunity to remain in business. We appreciated that. It kept us in business. We need to have a structural change in order for us to stay in business and do the kind of work that we've been doing. So with that, I want to thank the committee and the members for their time, and I'll turn it over to Ness.
Ms. Swan.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm here as a voice from our agency and the population that we serve, which is predominantly American Indian clients in the South Minneapolis area. Like every other testimony here in the ABE world, we're doing really good work with really minimal funding. We offer at our site distance learning, adult basic education, GED. We also do college prep for Accuplacer. We have a bridging program. We offer life skills. Our students are immediately immersed into career readiness training. We have a very strong employment services program with the MFIP host site, Minneapolis Works, and various other employment programs. So our students are immediately immersed into their career pathways. And we just are another one of those standalone CBOs that need additional funding. What's unique to our organization is that we're culturally contextualized services that not only weave indigenous culture in with the curriculum, but within the daily practices of our school. Our program's tailored to meet the student wherever they come into us at. This is reflected in our flexible hours, our programming schedule, our individualized tutoring services, and the reality that many of our students exhibit academic skill sets far below standard high school or adult levels, the major academic skills gap already present within the American Indian community. Our ABE services have deliberately braided within our organization's employment programs and our accredited post-secondary institution that we have within our agency for ongoing career training. So it's a one-stop model. These students they may start in our program, but they're weaving through other programs within the agency, leading to employment or post-secondary education. The recent equities investment allowed our ABE program to build capacity. We're now a GED testing center. We have increased curriculum offerings. We have distance learning. We have a new computer lab. And it also helped advance our regional footprint via our ongoing partnership with Northwest Indian CDC and Bemidji. So now we're a consortium of two. And so that we can better meet the needs of our American Indian students throughout the state. They're traveling back and forth. They have another location to also pursue their academic careers. The equities investment was crucial because due to the existing clause within the ABE funding formula, we're only allowed to access a base rate of $605 per contact hour, our program's primary revenue source. Our ABE program has been creative and adept at leveraging other assets operating within the greater American Indian OIC organization. We leverage licensed faculty from our post-secondary school and from our alternative high school to come to our ABE classroom and teach. We also leverage indirect costs. But owing to the contract hour allotment, it has been an ongoing struggle to provide the highest caliber academic and employment services for our students. We're unable to have a full-time instructor, and that's what's really needed in our classroom. We are proud of our status as an MDE-approved consortium, for we retain the autonomy needed to provide the services that most benefit our students and the clients that we serve, and what works best for them as learners. And we have zero marketing dollars. Our students come to us
by choice. They come to us because they've been referred by family and friends and relatives, three generations or more, that have had good experiences at our center, and they feel safe and comfortable there. They're choosing to come to our school. We anticipate the need for a culturally contextualized, career-oriented pathways. We're going in that direction with ABE. And in order for us to grow as an American Indian community in Minnesota, we need more funding. A recent Star Tribune article published last week established that a report issued by Minnesota Department of Education and the State Office of Civil Rights revealed that American Indian students are 10 times more likely to be expelled or suspended from the K-12 institutions, suggesting a trend that as a result of our K-12 system of education that's not working for them, they will eventually find their way into our ABE program. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your time. And if you have any questions, please let me know.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Swan and Mr. Gaither. All right. So I'm going to allow us to go until 10 of 3, so a very limited amount of time, and I apologize, but Representative Mariani put his name on the list for questions, and it could be for any of the testifiers on ABE. And if you have it for a specific person, go ahead. You can call them out. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be real brief. Partly I wanted to just out Tom because, you know, I love that time, man. And Mr. Sistrin Heisen and I have worked over the years on some really good things. I appreciate the service and all of you, you know, in this critical area. It seems to me this is sort of the little engine that could, you know, and it's where, you know, workforce issues and education really meets in a very real applied way. And I think among all the testimony, what I hear is, and I'll make this real brief, but, you know, my observation was just going to be really about how phenomenally innovative this whole ABE universe has been in the state of Minnesota. I've seen it evolve and adapt and flexibly change over the years. And I think even the last testimony testifies to the constant challenges that innovation really poses for us all. And so I won't ask the question, but I just really want to get out on the record that I think this is an incredibly important area for the state to continue to invest in. I hope that we can do something with the funding. It sounds like you're coming up with some creative ways to do that, and that's another thing that I've always looked forward to from the ABE community, is creative, responsible ways for us to continue to make important investments in this work as it continues to adapt and change. So I appreciate the opportunity to hear about them today, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Anyone have a quick question? All right. I had a quick question, and I think from one of the first three, because a question or a comment was made about the formula or that contact hours or how you're all funded, but it was I thought some of the school district money or the money that flows through the consortium goes to you as well. I'm seeing heads shaking now.
That's a common misperception. The three parts of the formula other than the contact hour rate are set under statute to go directly to the school districts. They could, if they chose to, share those with CBOs. To my knowledge, none of them do. So whether a CBO chooses to be part of a school district-based consortia or whether it chooses to be independent, they get the same funding, and the expenses they face are the same because they don't get any additional funding. So I think all CBOs could use and I think deserve additional funding, but I think it's really dangerous to pit one against the other, and I think whatever might be done really needs to apply to all CBOs equally to benefit the field in a fair way.
All right. And so thank you for that response. You know, the school districts, so does that money not flow back into their consortium members?
Their money is used to defray their own system. In statute, they do legitimately have some higher expenses. They are required under statute to use licensed teachers. Many CBOs do but are not required to. There's some other expenses they have that CBOs don't necessarily. So I believe that was why it was set up in the way that it was set up originally.
All right. Thank you. I think that's a good clarification. So I'm sorry, a great topic. And as always, we run short of time here in this committee. And Representative Nornes would probably like to set up for his committee, which is starting in less than 10 minutes. So with that, we're going to end. But thank you all so much for being here. Great topic. We are adjourned.